okay, does this still mean what we think it means?
Is somebody moving a bunch of stuff around in the background?
Robbie, how dare you?
Is somebody moving or clucking around in the background?
Hi, Robbie.
Can we say hi to Robbie?
Says hi, Robbie.
Hi, Robbie.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. The spread of COVID-19 has continued to upend American life. According to an ABC News poll late last week, 72% of Americans had canceled or postponed aspects of their daily life because of the virus. That's compared to just 26% when we last convened the Monday before. 80% of Americans now say that they are concerned that they or someone they know will be infected. So this is something that is affecting practically everyone. And today we're going to ask how politics is responding and what Americans think of those responses so far. We're also going to discuss how the virus is reshaping the 2020 election more broadly. So here with me to do that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Galen. Hey, everyone.
And also with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. Good to have you back with us. Hey, Claire.
Hey, Galen. Good to be here.
Awesome. And also with us is managing editor Micah Cohen. Hey, Micah.
Hi, everybody.
So initially, President Trump downplayed the threat of the coronavirus, along with other Republican politicians and Fox News. So, Claire, how have the politics of the coronavirus response changed now that it's actually upended so much of American life from coast to coast across people of different political beliefs, et cetera?
Well, you know, I think it's really hard to say what the long-term politics of coronavirus are going to be right now. I think we're in this really incredibly odd period of American life is an understatement. You know, we've seen the president basically in the past week kind of change the way he talks about the severity of the crisis, but kind of back and forth, flip-flopping. You know, he's been tweeting some stuff today about, 15 more days of sort of this really severe sort of shelter-in-place kind of stuff. But then after that, we'll assess, you know, maybe we'll do something different. And he calls the virus, you know, sort of an obvious racial slur or racial baiting. He calls it the Chinese virus. To me, that's something that we'll probably see throughout the general election campaign, even if, you know, this stuff is calmed down by, let's say, the late summer or early fall. But I really think we're still kind of watching this stuff emerge. I mean, we're going to talk about this, but there's a stimulus package under debate, right? This is an unprecedented thing because it is both a pandemic, a collective action that this country hasn't really had to take since, you know, I would say World War II, you know, it's a really big thing. But then also this crazy huge economic crisis that is in some ways more, you know, more easily graspable than 2008, because we all know why the economy's stalling, because we can't go out and buy things or do things. So I'm still really sort of waiting to see what the political effects are, because I think it's easy to say, oh, Trump, this will hurt Trump's, you know, standing and all that. But on the other hand, as we've talked about a lot in this podcast over the years, partisanship is really strong. When people are scared, politics can take on a sometimes unexpected tilt. So a long rambling answer to say, I don't know, Galen.
Yeah. Micah, what's your assessment of how politics has changed over the past week or two that this has spread and become more serious?
Yeah, I think Claire's note that we're only at the beginning is the right frame for this. We've talked about this on the podcast before, but polling in this case, because the story and the virus are both moving so quickly, polling is somewhat of a lagging indicator. That said, to me, the notable shifts in kind of political public opinion have been, not surprisingly at all, a big uptick in the share of people who are saying they're very concerned about this, right? Also, though, notably, a handful of polls have shown an uptick in the share of Americans, say, they approve of the way Trump is handling coronavirus, right? So for the first phase or so of this story, Trump's marks on coronavirus specifically basically matched his overall approval rating, which is to say he was underwater, right? Low 40s approve, low to mid 50s disapprove. A few polls out recently basically show the reverse of that. Low to mid 50s approve, low 40s disapprove. Will that stick? I don't really have any idea. But it is notable to me. Now, at the same time, sorry, I'm just throwing all this out there. The other shift we've seen is a big jump in the share of Americans who say they're concerned about the economy or their economic outlook is negative. So you have all those changes in the polling data, and yet Trump's approval rating is basically the same.
If anything, even ticked up slightly.
Well, I wouldn't really even ascribe much meaning to that. You know, it was like ticking down a bit, now it's ticking up a bit, but it's like, it's basically not moving. I don't know. Nate, you should jump on here on this.
One of the themes of coronavirus, and it feels like a theme of the news a lot of the time and a theme of some of the things we cover where we're looking at things over the long term, but there's a lot of kind of short run data that may be lagging to some degree, is like, this is really early in this crisis. It's really, really early. It's really early. And nothing that you can say takes away from the fact that it's really early. And you can twist and turn the data in different ways. I think it doesn't really tell us anything. What we know is that most of the time, when there is a severe economic downturn, that it's harmful for an incumbent president. That much we know. Number two, we know there's very likely to be a severe economic downturn for a period of a couple of months at a minimum, and there is dispute about how quickly we would recover, how deep it would be, how much bounce back you might have in the second half of the year, and that depends not just on the economy, but also on, is there like a second wave of disease that would occur, which is something a lot of epidemiologists think is quite possible. Number three is, oftentimes when you have a crisis, the short-run response is for people to, it's sometimes called rally around the flag if it's a war or security-related crisis, right? People want to support their government and support their leaders. In other countries like France, we've actually seen a bounce in like Macron's approval rating, for example. I know in South Korea, which has done an admirable job so far with controlling this crisis, actually, you've seen a bounce for approval ratings for leadership there.
Same even in Italy, where their response has been troubled. Conte's approval rating has gone up, even though they've had a lot of problems.
Right. So to me, there's a way to read it that says, well, Trump's approval rating is flat, roughly. That seems bearish. It means that he's not getting this rally around the flag bounce. And look at Bush after 9/11, where a very long series of events and the response to it in Iraq and whatever else eventually led to him being very unpopular after a period of time. And so, you know, I don't think you can, like, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to make too much of a cheap analogy, but it's like, you see things in the distance and like, and they're going to have an effect, and maybe they won't have the effect that we predict, right? But like, if you have negative 15% annualized GDP growth in the second quarter, that's probably going to have an effect on people. And we're now at the point where probably a lot of people are going to know people who have coronavirus. They're going to know people who are sick from it. They're going to maybe know some people who die from it. They're going to know a lot of people who are economically affected by it. Everyone's affected by this. I mean, so I don't really find the polls that interesting in the short run. And there are debates about like how much does the long run apply? Do people give Trump a break because it's coronavirus and it's not his fault? Well,
yeah.
I don't know.
I think,
you know, I think you can argue that like it's maybe more his fault than the average recession, and you can argue against that, and people will make those arguments. You're going to see also a lot of advertising from whoever the Democratic nominee is, presumably Joe Biden, right? I mean, I've seen like websites that are not partisan websites put together videos where it's like, here's all the calendar ticking off and all the times when Trump said this isn't serious, compared against the actual statistics that have come in.
I think Nate is right. Just to reiterate what I said before, I got this email from my friend Ben, and I think he phrased it so well at where we are in the crisis. He lives in California, so he's obviously in a similar place to New York. But he said, I feel like we're standing on a beach right now, looking out at a big tidal wave that's about to break over us. And all we can do is gulp air and look for something to hang on to. I think the next few weeks are going to be really bad. And I, you know, not to be whatever, I think that's true. And I think what's also interesting to watch with Trump, and you know, this podcast is sort of obsessed with the presidential race, but we're also seeing the sort of basic structures of the U.S. government, sort of the states versus the federal government, is coming into play in this crisis in really interesting ways. Obviously, Andrew Cuomo, you know, Governor Windbreaker, the guy who loves to hold a press conference, is really seen, I think, as a major national figure, even though he's just running the response for New York State. You saw, you know, Mike DeWine in Ohio. I mean, Ohio isn't as bad as New York, so it's sort of taken a little bit of a backseat. But he and the health director of the state sort of really taking drastic action and canceling the primaries, things like that. You've seen this interesting rising prominence of governors, which I've found just really, really fascinating. And I think the way that plays out over the next few weeks could also be interesting. I mean, Trump obviously has authorized the Defense Production Act, right? Which is basically gives, you know, the government a bit of leverage with U.S. industries needing to produce sort of needed supplies, like N95 respirator masks, things like that. So Trump certainly has ways to sort of be the wartime president that he, you know, I think sort of suits his personality and sort of mythology about himself very well. But it is, there's so many moving parts. I mean, you know, 2 weeks ago, I couldn't have imagined what we're talking about, you know? So it's good to keep that perspective.
Yeah. How does that tension between the state governments and governors in particular and the federal government and President Trump square? Like, is that just how federalism works? Or is it more that governors are filling in a void that in any other administration would be filled by the chief executive of the United States, the president?
I mean, we have a federal system where things are federal system, I should say, where things are devolved, where you have a lot of power for states and localities, which in some ways is good, by the way, because you can imagine that if Trump had control over all of this, that states would not be taking such aggressive measures and things could be a lot worse, potentially. And to some extent, it's probably good to have responsiveness that varies from state to state and locality to locality. I think that may be more important still whenever we are on the other side of the tunnel, because clearly, for example, you're going to have it be worse in some areas than others, in different cycles and trajectories in different areas at different times. It is interesting in light of this that, like, so few governors were major factors in the Democratic campaign. I wonder if that would be different if the campaign were happening next year instead. But look, I think the biggest problem, just to speak from like a public policy standpoint, is like the inconsistency in what Trump is saying, that it's all very ad hoc. Right?
Absolutely.
Because these are hard decisions. These are hard decisions. I think there's consensus that you have to shut everything down as much as possible for a few weeks everywhere, right? And beyond that, I think it's not entirely clear when it's smart and sensible to open things back up. It's not entirely clear which activities are more dangerous than others. It's not entirely clear how you manage trade-offs that occur and for how long, right? So there are like lots of things to debate, actually.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's pretty obvious that the reason why governors have sort of stepped into, I would say somewhat of the void is that A, they just are executives and right, like they're in charge of shutting down things in their states. But B, I do think that we should maybe talk a little bit about like the optics of the Trump, like if Cuomo does briefings with social distancing in place, Trump has been having these briefings first in the Rose Garden, now in the White House press room, where, you know, everyone's standing behind him and they're not social distancing, right? And you've got Tony Fauci, who I think is, you know, probably the most visible national medical figure in all of this, you know, kind of cringing at the way Trump is talking about this stuff. So there is this politicization that I think eventually, you know, Trump is putting health experts out there, but it takes that much longer to put the health experts out there. And there's that much more of a mixed signal. Again, I'll point back to this morning's tweets from him saying, giving the impression that perhaps in 15 days we'll reassess. Now, every single medical professional, epidemiologist, health expert, statistician, whatever you want to say, is very realistic that in 15 days, it probably won't be better. It'll be much worse, right? So there is this, I think, Democratic and Republican governors seem to be reacting in very similar ways, which is not particularly partisan. You know, it's a different story on Capitol Hill.
I think there's something of a debate amongst Democrats right now over whether they should, in this moment, while this crisis is unfolding, continue to criticize the president in specific ways about how they're dissatisfied with his response. You've seen some governors do that more than others. You've seen some political figures just in general do that more than others. Or if they should just try to work with him at the moment and deal with this all after the fact and craft their message once it's behind us. This is like a really, I think, crude political discussion to be having. But Claire, I think you've said this before, politics is crude. And this is the question that, you know, Democratic strategists at least are asking themselves. So what's the answer?
Well, there's a certain amount of misinformation correction that has to be done, both by Republicans, I think, or people within the Trump administration, but also by Democrats. But yes, of course, you know, this is like a time when Democrats want to be capitalizing on, aren't you scared that this guy is in the White House, this guy who is, you know, who has denied things, denied science, denied whatever, right? Like, that's certainly a political thing to catch on. I think, I don't know if we're going to move to this part of the discussion yet, but I've been sort of fascinated by the absence of the Democratic, people competing for the Democratic nomination.
Yeah, we'll get to that after the okay. break, but for sure.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think we're recording this, it's about 12 p.m. on Monday. There's some votes that are going to be happening today on Capitol Hill that, you know, who knows, by this evening we could see all the sort of angry back and forths that we're all very used to from Capitol Hill about this, whatever we're calling it, bailout, stimulus, blah, blah, blah. I mean, and in that sense, it's very, I saw some people sort of pointing back to 2008. Galen, you're probably too young to remember this in vivid detail, but there was...
Oh my God, don't call me out.
but, it, you know, in 08, a lot of more liberal Democrats, let's say, felt that they were almost, you know, also in the sort of manner of the Patriot Act before it, or the vote to go into Iraq, that they were sort of bullied by this moment of national unity, rally around the flag, be a patriot kind of thing, and accepted packages that were ultimately perhaps too forgiving to big business in the case of 2008. And that's what you're going to see over the next day or two, is congressional Democrats saying, well, you know, you're already seeing the term Trump slush fund sloshing around, right? So the idea of, listen, I'm no economist. Hi, Ben Castleman from the New York Times. Tell us what to do. But the idea that there will be massive unemployment is probably not a controversial thing to say. The idea that small businesses are closing, the idea that you know, so there will need to be worker protections, that there's a gig economy that now exists that didn't really exist in 2008, so there's even more workers without a safety net. There are some real things to consider about our particular moment in society and the economy, and some of those things are advantageous for Democratic policy ideas. I mean, we haven't even gotten into the universal basic income thing that's been moved into the mainstream in this real way.
Like, one thing I want to like slightly push back on is, I do think in some ways, I wouldn't put it the way that Trump has put it, but in some ways this is a thing where we're making a lot of decisions for 2 weeks or 3 weeks at a time, right? We can say with fairly high confidence that in 2 weeks from now, the decision that most people will probably recommend, most experts, will not be, okay, everyone go back to normal now. It'll probably be, maybe not, right? But like, we do want people to be evidence-driven. There are a lot of trajectories ranging from very bad to very, 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 very catastrophically bad that this thing could take, but those are differences that are pretty important. And so, you know, we do need kind of flexibility from policymakers. You can't just kind of circle a date on the calendar and say, here's when we do X, right? There are too many variables and too many unknowns. It's too likely to differ from region to region. You know, I think America has to think about things. What are things that even in the best case version that we have to do? I mean, even in the best case version, we have to shut things down now to get the number called R0, which is the reproduction number. How many people do I give it to if I get sick? You know, if I give it to 2.5 people, well, what if you can cut my contacts down by 2/3? Now I give it to less than one person. It begins to gradually die out. We need a lot more tests. That's part of the short run and the medium run answer. Short run because we know people who are sick. That has actually improved a lot over the past week. In the medium to long run, because it's a way to get back to normal now, right? Where now, if I feel sick, I have some flu-like symptoms. Well, now I can get tested faster and know, did I put people at risk? Am I required to self-quarantine or whatever else, right? We need that. We need to radically increase, I think, hospital capacity. That puts us in a much better place to deal with the downside scenarios. It's already a very scary problem in New York in particular. And we need economic policies that will help to ensure that short-term problems don't become permanent problems. You know, I have not seen all the details of every plan. I know Pelosi is still negotiating. It seems like smaller businesses do not operate on as long a margin. Businesses like bars
and restaurants and retail stores, it's a little bit worrying to me that there isn't a lot of focus on those businesses as opposed to airlines and cruise ships and whatever else, right?
Right.
Because those are places that if they close, well, you're going to have a lot of bankruptcies. You're going to have a lot of unemployment. Well, they might take a long time to kind of come back.
By the way, this doesn't quite go in with the sort of partisanship discussion that we're talking about, but I just feel like I need to say it somewhere. When all of, one thing that could affect, you know, long-term Americans' views on politics, I mean, we know that post-2008, starting in the early 2000s, Americans' trusts in various institutions plummeted. In addition to all of the factors that Nate just named, I mean, we have a huge shortage on necessary hospital equipment. I was on the phone 3 days ago with a very good friend of mine who's an ER doctor who's, you know, doing this. And he said, we're not wearing any of the right equipment, right? Friends who are public health investigators who don't have the right equipment investigating this stuff. Some of that is because states and the federal government were ill-prepared for this, right? And when you step back for all this, it's not going to be just a Trump problem, right? You can't blame everything on the Trump administration. Some of this is going to be Americans taking a look at what are the things that happened years in the past that made it so that we, the United States of America, the shining city on the hill, right, are wildly unprepared for this crisis from a medical point of view. And some of this has occurred with, you can point in the last, within the Trump administration, but some of this is kind of classic government bureaucracy gone a little bit awry. And I think that that's the kind of stuff that seeps into a nation's psyche long term and makes them say, yikes, isn't the basic, you know, fundamental Enlightenment era idea about democracy and this kind of government that we all have a social contract and that the government's first and foremost job is to protect us, and is it protecting us? And I think that's, again, it doesn't really even go into the idea of partisanship, but it goes into the idea of how will this dual crisis change America's political psychology going forward?
Yeah, and I think we have seen in crises past in American history that assessing the damage and finding a way forward, the social contract of America has been reexamined and reimagined. And sometimes that only happens if something does cut across partisan lines. If whatever the crisis is supersedes all of the tribalism and like enough people can come together to back a new set of policies or something like that. Micah, you mentioned that things were a little bit shifting potentially across partisan lines in the polling in favor of Trump. I mean, do you see any scenario here in the short term where like partisanship is just set aside and there is some broad consensus about what should be done?
There's no evidence of that yet. I mean, that could happen to, you know, what Claire said at the top of the show and Nate emphasized, we're at the very beginning of this. But if anything, the polling so far and the behavior of Congress so far shows that politics doesn't stop, right? So Trump's approval hasn't changed. The marks Trump is getting for his handling of coronavirus has gone up, but not that much. Like, probably that's some Republican shifting, maybe a little movement among independents. Look, I think to say the pattern we've seen in recent years is that, you know, there was a friend of the site, John Sides, and there was another political scientist, Robert Griffin, who wrote this for The Washington Post, that like, you know, under Obama and then under Trump, we saw that presidential approval ratings became increasingly divorced from the real world performance of the economy. That doesn't mean they're totally divorced, right? But more so than in past years. Will that hold if we're like Great Recession, Great Depression? I have no idea. My actual guess would be no, right? But is it meaningful that normal partisan allegiances are holding so far? Keep in mind, so far isn't like a normal, like, oh, some much ado about nothing political scandal, or even something really serious like child separation. This is the entire economy and people's lives grinding to a halt. And to date, there hasn't really been a shift in Trump's approval rating. Again, that doesn't mean there won't be one later. And it doesn't mean, to what you're talking about, Galen, that if this gets much worse, that, you know, those partisan lines could be broken and maybe we will see a long-term shift. But I think it's a little silly to be like, well, given the long-term uncertainty, we can't learn anything about what's happened today. To me, it's actually really meaningful, slightly depressing, that you have this case where this virus, this pandemic starts, an administration totally bungles the response, and there's not really a shift in how the public views him. I mean, that doesn't mean there won't be one later, but, like, you know, we've certainly learned more about how the public will respond in a situation like we have now. Again, that doesn't mean they won't respond differently in a different situation later.
I am not necessarily persuaded by this research saying that, oh, this kind of all fell apart during Obama and Trump, because number one, during Obama, the economy was pretty constant. There was a period where it was recovering. Then you had kind of slow growth of around 2% of GDP after that. So if you have no variation in the data, then you can't test the response variable. This would be a good test for Trump, but so far during Trump's economy, it's also been pretty steady until now. And so I don't think that, like, looking at just 1.5 data points, meaning Obama when you didn't really have anything to test, and then Trump where until now you haven't had anything to test, I don't think it's necessarily meaningful.
Yeah, I agree with that. I certainly, we have not got a test, as I said, of like a real downturn, a really painful downturn, or for that matter, like a crazy booming economy, although the economy was doing well under Trump for his first couple of years. But I get, look, the reason I subscribe a little more to that research than you do, Nate, is just because, like, it's not like it's this pattern without any theoretical explanation for it, right? There's a pretty simple and persuasive reason to believe that the economy would have less of an effect on presidential approval.
Can I raise something, which is that if this is an unprecedented crisis of dual pandemic and economic nature, maybe we should throw out the assumption that the economy is the only huge indicator. If millions of Americans die in the next few months, sorry, but I think that that's also like a kind of unprecedented thing that could shift things here and there. And while this is a huge economic story, I would again point to, like, it's a huge health story. It's a huge existential story. And I don't know what that translates into is, you know, as far as like presidential elections, but I think we're not in Kansas anymore, Dorothy.
I think there's an important point of background here that I don't think has been raised, which is that right now, Trump trails Biden by 7 points or so in the average national poll, which is enough for Biden to overcome any electoral college disadvantage that he might have. And so it's not like we're talking about a case where, oh, the polls say one thing, but these economic models say something else, right? Now we're talking about a case where kind of a polls-only model says Trump will lose by a margin, about like McCain lost in 08 to Obama, although not as a large electoral college victory, but, you know, by a pretty big margin. And now the economic models probably say he'd also lose. So kind of what are you hanging your hat on now from a forecasting standpoint to say that Trump is a favorite or even 50-50 necessarily? You know, because the whole theory was that, well, sure, Trump isn't doing great right now, but the economy will save him. Well, I agree with Claire, like a lot of things are unpredictable. And there are scenarios where things get back to normal sooner than people think because expectations are so bad. I don't think it's the most likely path, right? There's a lot we don't know, though, and we have to respect uncertainty on all sides. But there's not like a very linear argument you can draw for why Trump is in great shape, right? He's behind today. He's not terribly popular. And, you know, it's a little bit less clear now how things might get better for him.
I want to take a quick break here before we get more specifically into how this is reshaping the general election. So today's podcast is brought to you by Casper. Say hello to Casper, the sleep company with outrageously comfortable products that help everyone sleep and live better. Their ultimate goal is a world well slept. From award-winning mattresses to pillows, bedding, and furniture, Casper is transforming the way we sleep. With over 50,000 five-star reviews, it's the most loved and trusted sleep company. So don't lose sleep over finding the perfect bed. With bedding, bed frames, and even Glow, a magical light for better sleep, Casper has everything you need to complete your dream bedroom. Need time to decide? Sleep on it. Casper mattresses come with a 100-night risk-free trial. Rest easy with free shipping and free returns. Get the mattress of your dreams today. Go to casper.com/politics and use code POLITICS for $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. That's casper.com/politics, code POLITICS, to get $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. Terms and conditions apply. See casper.com/terms. Customer experience and product reviews are based on casper.com, authorized retailer sites, and Google. Today's podcast is also brought to you by ADT Commercial for Business. It's not politics as usual these days, and it's not business as usual at ADT. ADT Commercial serves businesses ranging from mid-sized organizations to large-scale enterprises. Think of them as national security advisors just for your company. They provide comprehensive security, fire, life safety, and risk management solutions, professional-grade systems for commercial-grade businesses. Businesses choose ADT Commercial. The Fortune 1000 trust ADT Commercial for highly complex, scalable, integrated solutions. And if you're looking for a great partner to upgrade or take over the monitoring and service of your current system, ADT Commercial can help to install and maintain large-scale and multi-site business dependably. Businesses choose ADT Commercial for their complex security solutions. Visit ADT.com/538 to learn more. That's the numbers, not the letters. ADT.com/538. We're back, and I want to get into more of how this is reshaping the general election, as Nate started to discuss. But Mike, I think you wanted to respond. So what were you going to say to Nate?
Just to Nate's point about all the indicators pointing in one direction in terms of Trump's reelection chances, you know, the polls and the kind of economic outlook. First of all, Trump's approval rating, remember, is not high to begin with. So the fact that it's remained steady doesn't bode well for him, right? You know, it hasn't worsened, but where Trump is now, you know, maybe a straight approval to reelection chances model would put him close to 50-50, but he's certainly not popular, right? But the other thing is just to Claire's point about the unprecedented nature of the situation we're in, and therefore maybe the economy isn't the main factor in how people are evaluating the president. The other thing I wonder about, you know, building off of that, is whether, let's say, there has been this divorce between economic performance and presidential approval. Do we start to see separation between presidential approval and voting? I'm like totally speculating here, but I do wonder a little bit whether presidential approval, do you approve or disapprove of the job performance Trump is doing or whatever? If that's become such a loaded question, it's such a marker of just base partisanship, that I wonder a little bit whether there are a lot of voters out there who would answer that approve, basically just saying like, listen, I'm a conservative, I'm a Republican, that's all that means to them, but wouldn't turn out for Trump in a general election, or would vote for a third party or whatever, right? This, again, that's totally speculative, but I do think like the more into uncharted waters we get, the more we have to be like, okay, does this still mean what we think it means?
Yeah, I think that is a really good point that Claire made, and Micah, that you reiterated. If a large part of the reason that we focus on the economy so much is because it's a measurement of how basically secure Americans feel and how optimistic they feel about their futures, then health and feeling like you're not going to succumb to a pandemic is also a measure of how you feel about how safe you are and how optimistic you can be about your future. So I think it will be important for us to keep track of what people are thinking about this pandemic beyond just what people are thinking about the economy. And in a way, to that point, up until now, I think we've kind of expected that President Trump and Republicans would use the economy as their main message during this reelection campaign. How is that changing now? What is the message that they pivot to since the economy is tanking? What's the strategy to get reelected in a situation like this?
I don't think they know, but
yeah, there is no message.
But I think
now
Trump has a sense that I go back to him calling it the racist, xenophobic Chinese virus. I mean, to me, that's like, you know, I can't place it yet within a general election strategy, but it kind of goes to the 2016 message of overseas, the move of companies to manufacture goods overseas has killed the American economy, aka China. Chinese factories are killing the American economy. Hey, look what the Chinese did to us this time. Like, you know, xenophobia worked really well in 2016. So you could see Trump's team being like, okay, well, this is not a great situation for us to be in, but maybe it does. And it does dovetail into his protectionist America first attitude kind of well, if he goes from that sort of like villainizing China point of view. But also, I think it's kind of like the obvious default playbook is wartime president.
Yeah. What about that term? Like, that's another way he's tried to frame this apart from, you know, calling it the Chinese virus, is more like, well, even if the economy is tanking, I can keep you safe, right? You know, I'm a wartime president and you can peg your security on me, right?
We've seen that from Trump.
Well, that's what he called himself. He said he sees himself as a wartime president. And, you know, there was just an article in the New York Times that came out last night basically saying that the Republicans and Trump's reelection team is pivoting towards this wartime president message as their reelection bid. I don't know if that makes sense. I don't know if it's effective, but what do you make of it?
Yeah. The way I view the Trump team's behavior now, and this is like one of the actual few benefits about Trump's tweeting, is you can kind of see his thinking in real time, but you can see, one, what Trump is anxious about in terms of his reelection, and two, you can see him trying out different messages, right? So yeah, you're right. We saw some of that kind of like wartime president, commander in chief, but we also saw, you know, to Claire's point, all cap tweet 2 hours ago from when we're recording. So this is, you know, he sent this out Monday morning. This is why we need borders, right? In other words, connecting this, as Claire said, to the message he already had. But ultimately, you can also see him anxious about the economy, right? I think anxiety about the economy is probably what's behind his tweet about, we cannot let the cure be worse than the problem itself. At the end of the 15-day period, we will make a decision as to which way we want to go. You know, this is speculation on my part, but my guess is Trump is starting to get worried about the economy and how that affects his reelection chances. And that explains that tweet more than like, you know, remaining flexible and fluid and evidence-based.
Yeah, because we should just interject. You should stay home, listeners. Like, not that we, just in case you're one of the, just in case you're one of the 21-year-old idiots down in Miami on spring break, stay home.
Claire, that's where I'm recording this from.
Yeah, I can tell. Beautiful sunlight there.
Yeah, it's a great day in New York City. Raining outside, so I assume everyone will stay in.
Can I sidebar for a second on those spring break videos? Aside from them being, like, stupid, I'm just imagining those kids, like, trying to get a job in, like, 2 years, and their employer Googling them and being like, oh, were you on a CBS News report about spring break?
I mean, they all look like they have, like, 6 STDs, too. I mean, they were, like, not looking like they were in great shape.
Wow. Two weeks of quarantine, and we go there.
Did anyone on the podcast ever do Florida spring break? Mike, you definitely did, right?
Oh, first of all, it's fucked up that you assume that I did.
You went to school
but
in
yes,
the South.
In high school, I went to Orlando 1 year for spring break with the golf team at my high school.
Micah was in New Orleans for college. That's like permanent spring break.
Yeah,
it was. Yeah, but you know, not in the way that you see in these pictures. I never did like that kind of spring break, you know.
You were never flouting the advice of the federal government while spreading a global pandemic?
I never flouted CDC advice. You know, other parts of the government I've really pushed back on. Not the CDC.
By the way, guys, you ever seen the movie Spring Breakers?
No.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I have. It's a good movie. It's a good movie. I liked it.
It's a good movie. It's about
Selena Gomez.
It's Harmony Korine and his take on like college spring break. Anyway, recommend.
Okay, so we should find a way to get back on course here so that we can finish this segment and end the podcast.
I have a substance. I mean, I do think one thing for Democrats to think about is that the notion of, hey, let me be careful how I say this. There might be a certain populist appeal to the notion of, hey, let's get back to normal, even if it means that some additional people die. I guess that wasn't a very
careful way to put it, right? But like, there are going to be people that, I mean, you already have people like, who was it, Ron Johnson, the senator from Wisconsin, kind of already said that. I think you'll see various subtle and not so subtle versions of that that Trump might argue, and, you know, and people might feel, okay, well, you know what? It's not going to affect me. It's going to run its course, you know, just kind of prolonging this for 9 months or whatever would just mean that all the same people die, but more. I mean, so like, there's something about a world where Trump is saying, hey, let's get back to normal, and you have all these elites saying, no, it's really dangerous, and people get fatigued, or people begin to feel like this has been going on for a long time, what are the costs to our businesses and our social lives and our communities and our churches. I mean, I think that is part of the unpredictability here.
But just to interject on that point, I mean, don't older people vote more? And given that older people are the susceptible group to COVID-19, isn't there some kind of, you know, political consideration there, even if you're not going for like the morality perspective here?
Yeah, and there is a flip side, right? There's a flip side where Trump is telling people to get things back to normal, that it kind of happens in a half-assed way. And in the half-assed way, what you could have happen is that the disease begins to spread at rates that are higher than one person passed on to one person, right? So the R0 is like 1.5, but meanwhile, the economy is not really great. And then you have like a second wave in the fall, and then everything is like kind of maximally crappy. And so I'm just saying, like, this is a bit unpredictable.
So we've been talking about this plenty from Trump's perspective and the Republican perspective. We've seen some commentary in recent days asking where Biden is. We have said at this point that the Democratic primary is not competitive. So, you know, what is Biden doing? What's his strategy here? Like, is it okay for him to just be in the background and for people to not really pay attention to him for a month while we're dealing with this crisis? Yeah, what's going on?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, honestly, it might be. Who knows? I wrote a little bit about I wrote some time in the last 7 days about what it's going to be like to have a presidential campaign without events. And, you know, there's been this hashtag trending, where's Joe? We should point out that both Biden and Sanders are currently, it appears to be self-quarantining, which makes sense. They're both people in their 70s at high risk for this. Or for a severe version of this thing. I mean, Biden's been doing these, like, Biden and Sanders have been trying to do these streaming events, which it's, like, not really clear how many people tune into them. The press notifications for them have sort of been weird. They're like, RSVP here, but you can just click on a link. I don't think a lot of voters are necessarily seeking out these, you know, here's my town hall or here's my fireside chat about coronavirus. So that's kind of remains to be seen how natural that is, you know, for people to be hearing the presidential candidates talk about this stuff, their take on it. The visuals for Biden's, he's been sort of ramping up these tele press conferences, and there's like a podium in his living room and he's behind the podium in one of them, which is kind of like odd optics. But the reason why, just to wrap up, maybe he doesn't need to be out there, right? Like, maybe Trump just needs to be kind of like too erratic person at the head of this crisis. And Joe Biden can like come out in 2 weeks and be like, yikes, right? This guy.
Micah, what do you make of where Biden is in all of this?
Yeah, this seems like a solution in search of a problem, really, right? Like from Biden's point of view, as long as the story is dominating the headlines are economic downturn, virus spreading, people getting sick, and Trump sort of bungling the response. Certainly, you know, I doubt Biden's rooting for any of those things. But in terms of like what is going to help his campaign to win the presidency, Biden doesn't really have any incentive to get out there, right? You know, it'd be one thing if Biden were an Obama-type charismatic leader who his stump speeches and his rhetoric was like a core part of his appeal, but he's not. So from Biden's point of view, being, you know, just a kind of mainstream generic Democrat staying, for the most part, out of the public eye, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. And by the way, even if Biden wanted to, you know, force his way into the national conversation, I'm not sure he could do it. Like, how would he, right?
The rhetoric point is so interesting, Micah, because in some ways it's like, it's this thing that was so much a part of America from 2008 to 2017 under Obama, right? The idea that he was making these soaring speeches about hope in the midst of this really dark time was part of his great appeal. And Trump is not a great orator, nor is Biden, for different reasons. You know, I think I'm actually sympathetic to Joe Biden's, like, not great oratory, in part because I think a lot of it is probably due to his childhood stutter. I mean, you know, he's long-winded. That doesn't have to do with the stutter. But he's not a forceful speaker. And it's interesting just from a pure, like, you know, just like the theater of politics, that there is no great oratory happening right now. You know, we do have Andrew Cuomo's sort of efficient press conferences and like this kind of New York-y efficiency, but there's no great, like, there's no great person standing at a podium saying, you're going to be okay, or we can all get through this.
Well, not only that, Claire, but if you're on Biden's team, my guess is Biden's team right now is saying to themselves, okay, how can we project an image that gets Americans to think, hey, we would want this person at the helm in a crisis, right? Which polls show, at least among Democrats, most of them did prefer Biden that way, right? But how can we project that image? The sort of easiest way to project that, I think, is kind of what's going on with Cuomo, right? Which is you the way you talk, you're a decisive speaker. Maybe you have an accent that's associated with, like, you know, decisiveness, right? But Biden, I don't think Biden doesn't really have that available to him, which isn't to say that in a crisis like this, he wouldn't be good at the helm or decisive or have like a better decision making process than Trump has. It's just that, like, the in terms of political rhetoric, the shortcut to communicate that, you know, he doesn't have that, which is
this is actually the time when, like, political rhetoric does matter. I mean, usually I'm the person who's like, I don't know, it's all bullshit and, like, it's all different ways of lying to you. But, like, it's a good time to remind people, like, in all seriousness, like the spring breakers, that there are, like, elderly people all around them, that there are, you know, there are homeless people. There are, like, there are lots of people that you're going to infect that you don't maybe, by dint of us being, like, a very, you know, a quote-unquote first world country, we don't think about the massive poverty and inequality that exists here. But, like, this is a time when you're literally supposed to think about your fellow man. And I think the American people are getting, like, a lot of mixed messages about that, which probably leads to certain people not taking it seriously. And, like, if there were, you know, God, the term viral video now takes on different meaning. But, like, imagine if there were, you know, one person that a lot of people in the country looked up to saying something very affecting and moving about, think about your fellow man, think about the people you're hurting with your actions. This is an extraordinary time. Like, I do think at this point in time, you do kind of need someone doing that. And you don't really have it.
Yeah, that's definitely happened in Italy with the prime minister. But go ahead, Nate. What do you make of how Biden is handling all of this?
I'm not very sure that it matters that much. One thing, kind of pursuant to the discussion earlier about Trump's favorability rating, is that, like, people have actually been maybe a little bit less partisan than usual because people realize it's a crisis. They realize that, like, they don't want to, I mean, frankly, like, they probably don't want to trigger President Trump into doing stupid things that could really hurt the country or something also, right? That's not going to be true by the time we get to the election. There's going to be lots of arguments about how this is Trump's fault. There's going to be lots of second guessing of what he did. And Biden reserves all his options to go in later on when we know more and second guess and criticize Trump. I mean, I'm not quite putting it the right way, because, like, a lot of things that probably were in the second guessing will be in the first guessing also, right? Lots of experts from around the country, around the world, were saying Trump is not taking this as seriously as he needs to. And there is a lot of videotape evidence of him not taking it seriously, which will make for very effective commercials for Democratic candidates, for Biden as well as for the Senate and whatnot. But, like, I don't know. I mean, you could kind of have Biden, I was talking about this the other week, have, like, a shadow cabinet where he's trying to provide advice. I'm not totally sure how well that would necessarily come across. If you have kind of Biden acting as kind of pseudo president, maybe it would go well. Maybe it would go terribly. I don't know, right? But there's like not that much to be gained, I don't think, right now. And I'm not sure there's that much to be lost either. But one advantage of not being the incumbent is like, you don't have to make these decisions in real time. You can sit back and apply all the hindsight bias you want, saying, okay, well, this was done poorly and this should have been done differently. And to some extent, then, you know, I don't know why you have to be on top of everything if you're Biden or whatnot.
Yeah, and Biden certainly hasn't, you know, he hasn't gone full bore attack on Trump, but he certainly hasn't. He's been critical. You know, he said at one point, let me be clear, Donald Trump is not to blame for the coronavirus, but he does bear responsibility for our response. And I, along with every American, hopes he steps up and starts to get this right. You know, that's pretty critical, starts to get this right, right? So, yeah, but I'm with Nate. Like, I don't think Biden could do much to start making headlines, and I don't think he has any incentive to do much to start making headlines.
All right, well, I think we should leave things there. It's been a very energetic podcast. Glad to have all four of us together again. Yeah, let's leave it there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thanks, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thanks, Micah.
Thank you. See you guys.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.